welcome to Minute 51 of Season 3 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1988 Bruce Willis action flick Die Hard, one minute at a time. I'm Rob, and I first want to say that we have a very special week for everybody. We're actually going to be recording one-on-one with our guest in Boston. I happen to be in Boston this week, and I decided to do this, I guess you can sort of say live, one-on-one. I've never done this. I've done over 300 shows, and this is the first time that I've actually done one-on-one, so I want to welcome my guest for this week, Sean German of the Next Scene Podcast. Welcome. Welcome to the show, but I'm actually being welcomed to your house.
Welcome. So yeah, welcome to my home, to my recording studio, and thanks for having me on the show. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah.
And excited to have you here.
Yeah. And I'm excited to, you know, to be doing this live. It's a lot of fun, or at least we hope it's supposed to be a lot of fun. We haven't, you know, I haven't done it yet. So we'll see. So thank you very much, Sean, for your hospitality and for you know, letting me stay here all week in your in your office. You know, maybe we'll find some drawer that I can you know, fit myself in, or actually, you know what, this is a good week. Maybe you have like an air conditioned duct or something like that
that I can
find my way through.
I have a duct you can kind of cuddle up in. It's nice and cozy.
It'll okay, all right. Just try not to shoot me or point the gun in my direction. You know, if you get a little antsy during the course of the week.
I'll try.
All right, that's fair. That's fair. So Minute 51 begins with the strap beginning to move and ends with a shot of a dark air conditioning unit shaft. So on Friday, we finished the whole idea that, you know, McClane is trying to stay as far away from Carl, Franco, and Fritz. And he's, you know, running around the little maze that we have there on the... I guess the floor right below the roof, you know, and he's you know, I mean, I like the way that he's zigzagging around, going through the same room over and over. You know, he gets to keep seeing the pictures of the, you know, the models on the wall to tell us and to tell him where he is. But what we got here is you know, he decided that he needs to get off of that floor. So he thought of this great idea that he's gonna take his gun, which apparently he ran out of bullets, and that's why he doesn't want to use his gun anymore. And, you know, he's gonna try to lower himself down. Not very smart, if you ask me.
Yeah, no, this seems like a very iffy movement. I guess in the situation, you've got to make do, and he's kind of, I guess, like MacGyvering together whatever solution he can. You know, making do with what resources are at hand, but this all seems very iffy. At the very least, it seems like he could have done a better job of making sure that strap was attached to the gun before he lowered himself.
Well, it was attached to the gun, but, you know, not as securely as you would think. But then again, you know, when you're putting it on the gun, you're not going to really be interested in holding a person. The idea is that the person's holding the gun as opposed to the gun holding the weight of the person.
The gun holding the person.
Yeah. You know, it's the strap is not meant to hold the person. The strap is meant to hold the gun.
The fire of the gun.
You know, it's the whole thing, you know, like you buy something that's made to be used a certain way. And if you do it another way, you know, there's obviously no liabilities. But also from the other perspective, you know, you have to think about what you're doing.
Yeah, I think he's voided the warranty on the firearm.
Yeah, probably. But he doesn't have the warranty anyway because it's Tony's. It's
not his
gun. So there you go. Tony's the one who signed off on it.
Right.
You know, who knows? So we get to see the way that this gun starts to, you know, it's shaking a little bit, but you see the strap start to unravel. You know, we mentioned last week that this is very reminiscent of, you know, 5 years later when they did Cliffhanger, where they do the same thing. You know, you slowly have the, you know, the strap open up and, you know, start saying, oh, what's going to happen? Is this going to, I mean, it's obviously foreshadowing something that we know is going to happen. Yeah. It's not, you know, it's to add to the tension, but we just don't know how it's going to happen. We know it will happen, but the question is how.
Yeah, how and when. And one thing this film does really, really well is that buildup of tension. And then the release, you know, we know this is a risky move. And then we see that strap start to slip and we know, you know, is he going to make it to, you know, the other side of the duct or the other side of the shaft here in time? And then it releases, he falls, but then he catches himself.
Right.
And then
but the music is also great here because of that. I mean, Michael Kamen did a great job adding so much tension just with the music, you know, you have little notes here and there that you like listen to and you're like, wow, what's gonna, you know, how, especially the first time you're watching this. I mean, like, what's your history with the movie? Do you remember the first time you saw it?
I do not. I mean, it would have been a while ago. I don't think I saw this in the theater, but I was around when it came out, when it was new, and we're into the realm of home video. So, this was probably a rental for me, probably when it hit home video. Mm-hmm. Would have rented it and watched it at home. So, yeah, I don't think I've ever seen it in the theater, but I've seen it many times.
As I mentioned, a few weeks ago, I saw it for the first time on video. Mm-hmm. A friend of mine, you know, we watched it in his house, but his parents didn't let him watch R-rated movies. We were 14 at the time. And every time his parents walked by, we had to, like, change the channel. You know, so we were like, we were watching a stop motion film. Mm-hmm. That's more or less what it was. But then that same summer, which was the summer of 89, the movie came out in 88, but in 89, I remember when it came out on HBO, and I just watched it over and over and over on HBO. You know, it was a lot of fun. And, I mean, we're actually going to get, later in the week, there's a line that they mentioned here that I always remember was on the promo on HBO. And so we'll get there later in the week. Just a little bit of a teaser for people to come back, you know, stick around to hear what we're going to talk about that. So, you know, the way that you see him hanging there is also done really well. You know, one of the things that I love about this movie is you don't have rippling muscles. Mm-hmm. You know, at least not from McClane. You know, I mentioned earlier about Cliffhanger. Cliffhanger, even though, you know, Stallone is supposed to be in every man there, McClane is here, or Willis is here, right? But he still has the rippling muscles. Here, they don't have that. They don't try. They want the viewer to look at it and say, this could be me. You know, I don't need to go to the gym, for 7 hours a day for I don't know how many years in order to have, you know, my veins popping out on my muscles and stuff like that. But, you know, you look at John McClane and you're like, okay, this could be any of us.
Yeah, this really, and I can't think of a big action film before this that kind of fits that mold. In the 80s, it was Stallone and Schwarzenegger and even the action.
And starting with Seagal. I don't know if Seagal was really, I guess he was less of the muscle bound guy.
Right. But even the action stars that weren't muscle bound were kind of martial artists like a Seagal,
right.
Or Chuck Norris or someone like that who, you know, even if they weren't big bodybuilders, they weren't, you know, kind of just average Joe off the street.
Right.
John McClane as a, you know, as New York City policeman, I'm sure there's some physical requirement. You know, he's not, you know, completely a civilian, but yeah, he doesn't have the rippling muscles. He's not someone who's trained in martial arts. He's closer to the everyman, closer to us in the audience.
And I think that's why it works so much better. You know, because it takes the viewer and puts them that, okay, this could be me or someone I know.
Yeah, right.
You know, that type of thing. You know, I know an NYPD cop. It could be him. You know, it's like, it's not, oh, I don't know anyone who looks like Schwarzenegger or Stallone. So, you know, there's a little bit of that disconnect, you know. But, so they do the shot really well. By showing it, and then, you know, you see him like he's reaching over, trying to get to the other vent, and again the edits are great because you see him reaching over, and then they flip back to seeing the gun, and you see the strap unravel a little bit more, which is obviously even more unrealistic because, you know, the strap isn't that big. You know, for us to get so many seconds of the strap, you know, I can talk from personal experience, and I'm sure most people can think about it. You know, if you have like a backpack, you know, where the strap is opening up, it opens up in a second.
Yeah.
And a backpack doesn't have, let's say, 150 pounds of weight on it right now, pulling on the strap. You know, we'll say that he's 150 pounds. He's probably even a little more. But, you know, on a knapsack, it just unravels within seconds. But here, it's taking a little bit longer just to be able to add a little bit more to the tension and stuff like that. And they do it really well. And when you see him reaching towards the air duct, it also makes you feel as if you could be in that type of situation. I mean, we've all been somewhere where you're reaching for something which just slightly out of your fingertips, and you're like, oh, I can still do it. You know, not necessarily in death-defying situations like this one.
But certainly, yeah, then you just think, oh, I can
just a little bit more, another inch,
kind of stretch the joints a little bit just to make it.
Yeah, and I mean, you don't have such a long drop,
yeah.
or 33-plus floor drop. You know, and I also like the way that not just is the strap starting to unravel, but you see the gun lift up a little bit, you know, that he's pulling on that also.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I mean, I don't know well enough the physics of it all as to, you know, I would think that it would just get unwedged at that point.
Right.
You know, it wouldn't last as long as it does here. And then we get a shot of Carl opening the doorway that McClane had just gone through, and he looks in, you know, he opens it in a very funny way, because if someone's standing on the other side with a gun, they're just going to shoot him in 2 seconds. You know, it's not the smartest way to open a door if you think someone's, you know, might shoot you.
Right.
But then again, that's what they've been doing the last few days anyway, you know, with trying to get into, you know, these actors are not portraying, you know, professional assassins well enough, I guess you could say, from that perspective. Because the two guys in the back also, one of them, you know, you see Fritz is just standing there with his gun pointed, but he has this blank look on his face, and Franco has the gun up in the air, which, again, as we discussed, I think, last week or 2 weeks ago, trying to run after somebody with your gun in the air doesn't really help you. The idea is you want it to be pointed at whoever you need to point it at. You know, if you're holding it up,
yeah,
you want to be...
Yeah, I mean, the safest thing is to have it pointed down at the ground, but they're not interested in necessarily in safety.
The safest where? The safest if you're in, you know, if you're at a shooting range.
Well, yeah.
Safest if you're in training or something like that. But if the idea is you're expecting that there's a possibility that someone's going to jump out and shoot you, you want to have it.
Want to have it pointed straight ahead.
Straight ahead of you.
Yeah.
You know, and they... You know, whoever was in charge of training the actors here in these situations don't really do it very efficiently. You know, I think nowadays, because of Dale Dye and stuff like that, things are a little more efficient and realistic. You know Dale Dye is, right?
I don't recognize the name.
Okay, so he was in Platoon. That was, I think, one of his first movies that he was in. Okay. He was friendly with Oliver Stone. He is a former soldier. And he opened up a company that basically trains actors in a whole bunch of combat situations and what they need. You know, he does like a boot camp for them. There's so many movies that he's run the boot camp. You know, that you have Saving Private Ryan, and you know he always has like small roles in most of the movies that he's in. That he does the boot camp in.
Okay.
You know, and so. You know, this movie did come out 2 years after Platoon, but they still, it doesn't look like they utilized his services. You know, like, I don't know, have you ever seen Band of Brothers?
Yes.
So he did that also, and he was in Band of Brothers.
Yeah.
He played one of the characters in there. And I think he was in Saving Private Ryan also. Yeah, he played like a colonel or something like that.
You know, in general, movies are not good reference points for handling firearms.
Well, especially in today's environment. But, yeah. You know, in general, they try to do it well. I mean, last week, my guest, Kurt Kenny, was talking about the fact that when he was directing episodes of the Blacklist, mm-hmm. so he said that the guys who were, the whole team that was dealing with firearms did an amazing job mm-hmm. about safety and all that stuff. You know, unfortunately, not everyone... Is like that,
well,
you know, not in every situation and stuff like that. But also, if it's obviously very sad about what happened last year, but if you think about the amount of movies that deal with firearms mm-hmm. and you know, looking at the number of accidents, it's still a very low percentage. It should be zero. There's no question about that. Don't get me wrong. There, I'm in no way advocating otherwise. But my point is that it still shows how much professionalism there is you know, but the hundreds of movies and TV shows that are filmed every year that need to have this type of safety, you know, and even if you have a few accidents along the way, so the percentage is still very high, you know, but we want to get that number down to below zero even.
Yeah, zero would be good.
Yeah. Even less than zero is good too.
Less than zero.
And then we get another shot of John, you know, back in the shaft. And he realizes he's not going to be able to make it so easily, so he grabs the strap even harder. And again, if that strap was already coming apart, there's no way he hasn't fallen already. You know,
yeah,
he's putting a lot of weight on it. You know, at one point you see that he's even holding himself up with one arm, which means he's really pulling on it.
Yeah, kind of all his weight is on that strap.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not a physics person, but I would think that he would be exerting probably even more force than his weight because he's pulling on it also. It's not just holding him. There's also his force of him pulling it.
Right, because he's not just hanging straight down. Right. He's pushing off the wall to try to reach. Now, I wonder why. So he's, when he's pushing off, he's kind of got his toes in. It looks like his foot is perched on one shaft and he's reaching across to, you know, exit on the other side.
Right.
Why doesn't he just crawl into where his feet are?
Maybe he wants to make it more difficult for Carl and his men to get to him, because if he's just one floor below, so then, okay, they're just going to go down one flight.
Right.
Here they now actually have to try and find him in somewhere along this maze.
Right. So, yeah, so instead of being just, one floor below where they are, now he's kind of the other side of the building.
Yeah.
Which, I mean, it works out and that makes sense.
Yeah,
that's true. But if he doesn't make it, if he doesn't catch himself...
Yeah, then, but it doesn't mean he's going to be able to catch himself if he's one floor below either.
Right.
You know, you're not just going to let go and slide yourself down. He's holding on the floor below with his feet.
Right.
It's not as if he can grab on.
Right.
You know, I think he would fall head over heels that way if he slips, if he's trying to do it just from his, you know, just from where his feet are holding on to it. You know, but he tries to get a better grip on the strap, and then we get another shot of Carl, who is now actually, it looks like he's entering the room that John was hanging out of. You know, he's getting very close, and he was looking down, trying to find him, and then the shot switches again to John, once again, trying to lean across, try to grab onto to that other vent, and then... You know, once again, it shows us the gun, which is still unraveling. You know,
the tension is still building.
Yeah, and it's a very, very long shot. And then the strap lets go. You know, we hear the snap, and then great cut to see John actually fall also. Now, do you know the history of this, of the filming of this scene?
I do not.
Okay, so basically, this was an accident. The stuntman was actually supposed to grab onto the duct that he's aiming for, but the stuntman screwed up. Okay, he actually slipped and he continued to fall, but they loved the way that the shot was because he was able to grab. He actually in the real filming he wasn't even able to grab it because if you watch he just falls. You know, you don't see John grab on in the same shot.
Right, they cut away.
They cut away, and then they added it in, and, you know, it adds even more tension to the fact that he actually missed it. As opposed to, you know, I'm assuming that stuntman got reamed out that day. I'm sure they yelled at him a lot for messing up the shot. Until they were looking at the dailies, and they're like, hey, wait a second, we can actually do something with this.
Yeah, a happy accident.
Yeah, exactly. And... You know, I like the way that they show him grab on. You know, things work well.
Yeah. Now, I think this is a little unrealistic that he is, he is falling and maybe he can slow himself a little bit sliding along the walls of, of this shaft. But he's basically in free fall.
Yeah.
And he grabs and he stops himself. Just by the tips of his, his fingers, because it's not like a bar that he can grab onto. It's a flat surface.
Right. Well, we're talking about that he doesn't have muscles, but he apparently does a lot of finger exercises.
Yeah.
Because those fingers are nice and they're able to grab on. they're the ones that it works. And I mean, come on, you want to talk about unrealistic? Just continue what happens here. You know, he's able to actually climb up the side of the shaft with his bare feet. You know, he's got nothing to grip onto or anything like that. He's holding it with his fingertips to the edge of the vent, and he's able to lift himself up and walk up the side of the shaft with his bare feet.
Yeah.
You know, there's no traction or anything there. So it's a little strange the way they do it, but it's still fun.
The wonders of adrenaline. Well, I guess he would have been, from the adrenaline and the action, there'd be some sweat. I don't know if that, you know, would that make his feet sticky? Would that make him more slippery?
I think it would make him more slippery. I would think it would be more slippery that way.
Yeah.
You know, and this whole time we see Carl still trying to find him. You know, he's walking slowly. Now, the two henchmen are nowhere to be seen. Carl is there by himself. You know, Fritz and Franco basically said, all right, you find him and then we'll come, I guess. Yeah. I don't know.
They're like, Carl, you go ahead. We got your back.
Yeah. And then we get a shot of him actually crawling through the duct. You know, he's able to get into it. It's pitch black. Mm-hmm. And he starts walking through it. Now, me just looking at this makes me claustrophobic. You know, I don't even need to. I'm not claustrophobic. But just looking at the way that he is crammed in there. You know, he really does look like a TV dinner, you know, just crammed into this aluminum, you know, duct the whole time.
Yeah, this would bother me. Now, it looks like it's...
Are you claustrophobic?
Not usually, but but I'm also usually not in that confined of a space. It would worry me because he can fit through. I'm not, looking at this, I'm not concerned that he's going to get stuck and won't be able to move,
but... I think Schwarzenegger's not here because Schwarzenegger wouldn't...
Yes, Schwarzenegger would not fit. But also, he cannot... like turn around.
Right.
You know, if he suddenly needs to reverse direction, he just has to crawl backwards. He can't.
Correct.
Or if, you know, if there's something else in that duct and he feels something like clawing or biting at his toes, like there's no way he can see what that is.
That's true also. Yeah, it's a good point. And so he like inches himself along, tries to think. So like claustrophobia, right? Just to let everyone know who's interested in a little bit more information about claustrophobia. So claustrophobia is the fear of confined spaces. It can be triggered by many situations or stimuli, including elevators, especially when crowded to capacity. Windowless rooms, hotel rooms with closed doors and sealed windows, sometimes even bedrooms with a lock on the outside, small cars, tight-necked clothing can also induce a response in those who have severe claustrophobia. Wow. Just your clothes can make you feel claustrophobic. That's very interesting. I never thought about it.
I know sometimes I've had a turtleneck that was too tight that made me feel uncomfortable.
It made you feel claustrophobic, or you just...
I don't know if that qualifies as uncomfortable.
I put on a little bit of weight. You know, that's what I, you know, I put on the shirt and you're like, okay, it's a little bit. So, yeah. You know, I need to lose a few pounds in order for the shirt to fit back on. I don't feel claustrophobic at that point. Right. You know, and it's typically classified as an anxiety disorder, which quite often can result in panic attacks. And many onsets of claustrophobia can be caused by many different things. Sometimes it could be dealing with, you know, conditioning or something in the brain that will let people do it. How many people do you think in the world are affected by claustrophobia? What percentage? You have a random...
I would say just like 1%. I don't think it's too common.
Okay. Actually, they did a study and they came across that it's anywhere between 5 and 10% of the world population has some form of claustrophobia. Most of them are not being treated for this disorder. I guess it's more just the idea that someone can be in a place and feel maybe the walls closing in a little bit. I'm assuming that this... They're not talking here about severe claustrophobia with that number. I think that number would probably be much closer to the 1% that you said. But, you know, the 5 to 10%, it just probably means people that feel a little bit uncomfortable in those type of situations or whatever. And where do you think the word claustrophobia comes from? Any idea the etymology of it? What would you think?
I mean, I would guess Latin or Greek just because so much of... so much language, and particularly when talking about medicine, a lot of terms come from Latin. I don't know.
Okay, well that's a very good guess because the first part of the word is from the Latin and the second part is from the Greek.
Oh, there you go.
So yeah, that's pretty good, Sean. There you go. Right. So the Latin word claustrum, which means a shut-in place, and the Greek term phobos means fear. So it's a combination of the two.
Okay.
So that works well in this type of situation. And, you know, we see him inching his way through this duct. I love how he reaches behind with his arm in order to reach into his pocket, you know, to pull out the lighter.
The lighter, yeah.
You know, which is, it doesn't look very comfortable the way that he's doing it. And it also, it reminds me, like in Lethal Weapon, the whole idea, you know, that he needed, you know, he was able to dislocate his shoulder all the time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that it looks more or less that's what McClane is trying to do here. You know, in order to be able to reach into their pocket. Because I don't know if I would be able to reach into my pocket at that point. If your arm is in front of you, and then you need to, you know, in this type of shaft, to reach back and pull it out. But
yeah, I mean, there's just barely enough room for him to kind of swing his arm through.
Yeah. And then, you know, he gets the lighter in front of him, and he lights it up. So, you see, I love, one of the things I love about this movie is there are so many aspects of the story, the visual storytelling that, you know, we saw that he took this lighter off of Tony
mm-hmm.
a few weeks ago. But, you know, here we go. It's showing up again. He's not just taking the lighter. I mean, and you think he's taking the lighter to light up a cigarette, not necessarily to, you know,
for illumination.
Give himself a little bit of light in this very dark, you know, air conditioning shaft. So that's done really well. And again, you get to see the fact that his watch is on backwards.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he puts the face of the watch on the bottom part of his wrist as opposed to the top.
Yeah, I don't know. Is that a military? Is that a police thing?
It is a military thing. Yeah. Okay. It makes it easier if you're, instead of, you don't have to turn your arm because your arm is straight and then you just take a look at it as opposed to turning it, you know, to look at it.
That's like a more natural position to have the inside of your wrist facing you.
Yeah. Yeah. That's definitely true. And I mean, looking at him here again, do you remember what he did with the gun right before, with the pistol? His gun right before he went out the shaft.
Yeah, is it like the back of his waistband?
No, he put it in the front.
In the front,
which means that must really Ooh. Really hurt that he's right now crawling through the shaft. I mean, later in the week when he takes it out, it's probably very uncomfortable. You know that he was taking it out also from there because you have to reach under yourself to pull up the gun. You know that type of thing. So you know he does a nice job of that. And then they give us a great shot of the rest of, or from his perspective, of the air conditioning duct. Mm-hmm. You know, like there, it, and you can see he's got a far journey to go through here.
Yeah.
You know, which on the one hand, okay, he can get to safety, but on the other hand, it's going to take him a while to get to that safety.
Right. You know, we saw him a little bit.
And as you mentioned earlier, if someone or something is coming from the other end, he's screwed.
Right. Definitely. Yeah. I mean, he's just going to be inching along slowly, pulling himself through. And yeah, he's got a ways to go. And also, it just looks like there's no landmarks. There aren't too many distinguishing features in terms of figuring out where he is and, you know, one place versus another.
Correct. All right, and that's how this minute ends. Do you have anything else you want to say about the minute before we get into the script?
No, that's all I had for this minute.
Right. So surprisingly, I mean, we've had minutes where there's nothing in the script. This minute has a lot of description as to what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
You know. So first of all, it starts off where you know it shows McClane and it says he's overhead. He's overheard enough of the conversation. He was listening to the conversation. He apparently, according to the script, was able to hear the conversation between Carl and Hans that we talked about on Friday. So it says he's overheard enough of this to realize he's in deep shit. He backtracks to the air shaft door, strikes a cigarette lighter, and then it says, hearing Carl approach, McClane thinks fast, looks down at his narrow confines, and then at his weapon, and its canvas gun sling and metal strap slides. So one of the things that happens in the script that is not happening in the movie is it's completely dark. That's why he needed to light up the lighter right beforehand. Also, I like the fact that it's that it has lower illumination. You know, that he doesn't need to be walking around with a flashlight or a lighter or something like that. You know, we can see what's going on. There would, you know, movies that do things where everything is pitch black. It's more difficult for the viewer also. You want to be able to see what's going on, as opposed to just having to wait for them to light something up.
Right. So this is a good balance in terms of we can see what's going on, but it's a realistic level of light. Because obviously he's not going to be in full daylight in the air duct.
Right. And then it says, McClane quickly lets out all the slack in the sling. Then he braces the weapon across the outside opening of the air shaft door and lowers himself into the air shaft. Meanwhile, holding onto the canvas sling with his elbows bent over, it is like a kid doing a half-assed skin the cat on a swing set. Do you know what that is? I've never even heard of that either. I wasn't able to figure out what it is. Skin the cat on the swing set.
Yeah, I haven't heard that phrase. Skin the cat on a swing set.
I haven't either. His feet slowly move down the smooth aluminum walls until they reach the top of the air duct, then dangle in the open space. He straightens his arms to give him length enough to touch the bottom edge of the duct. Suddenly, he feels something give above him and looks up. It was designed to carry a gun on a man, not vice versa. The few inches of extra canvas are sliding through the clips. When they're gone, he will be too. So, you know, according to the script, it gives McClane an indication that something's giving way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's something that I prefer the way that they do it in the movie. You know, that we don't see that he's concerned about it. That it's better that he's also taken by surprise by the whole thing. You know, and then it says that one of the canvas ends slips through the clip and McClane begins to fall. He grabs the ledge of the air duct as he falls and his body slams into the aluminum wall with an echoing boom. So again, he doesn't reach the other side. He does what you said, that he just needs to get to the duct on the floor below him. Right? So McClane, holding onto the ledge by his hands, with every ounce of strength, he tries to pull himself up into the horizontal duct, clawing for a hold. Carl rounds the corner and sees McClane's rifle lying beneath the doorway. He moves to the small door, shines his light, and aims his rifle down into the air shaft, ready to fire. The shaft is deserted. Moving his light around, he sees the air duct. Without hesitation, he turns and backtracks to the pump room. So, I mean, this is giving away a little bit of what happens later in the minute, in tomorrow's minute, but it's still nice that, you know, that I like the way that they describe it here. You know, he gets into the room, he sees McClane, or he sees the gun.
Yeah.
You know, so it shows that Carl is a lot brighter than you would think. You know, he's able to quickly figure out, okay, this is what's going on. McClane is here. What I need to do is get to figure out where he, you know, which duct he's now in, as opposed to where he was.
Right.
So, right. Those are the differences from in the script for this minute. So every Monday we have a segment called Die Hard on a Monday, where my guest will give their top five Die Hard genre movies.
Okay.
So what have you got for us, Sean?
All right. So hopefully I've got a good five.
Well, if you like them, then they're considered a good five.
Okay.
This isn't a contest. You know, you don't have to make sure that you have the best ones that other people like. This is what Sean German likes.
So this is what Sean German likes. I've got five. So I'm going to start with Skyscraper from 1996 with Anna Nicole Smith. And I will say this is a so bad it's good for me. This is not a great film. It's not does not have great reviews, but I think it's fun. It's pretty much the same. It's pretty much Die Hard. It's Die Hard in a building,
but in a building. Okay,
I know it's a you know
it's an interesting concept.
It's interesting concept. It's so crazy. It just might work, but in this case, it's and I'm not sure if this
and it doesn't
was,
have The Rock in it. Yeah.
No, this is not the one with The Rock. And I'm not even sure if this was like if this was a serious turn at trying to turn Anna Nicole Smith into an action star, or if this was done tongue in cheek, or, you know, I don't know what the intention was in making it, but I know the result is not good, but I think it's not good in a fun way. I will say it's up on YouTube. The whole film, in its entirety is available on YouTube. If you want to look it up, I will warn the viewer that some scenes have not aged well at all, particularly,
Anna Nicole Smith or the movie.
Anna Nicole, the film has not aged well.
Right.
The film has not aged well. There are, sexually explicit scenes. There are, including
they can show on YouTube.
On YouTube.
Wow.
Yeah. Including some sexual violence. And that's a, one particular scene that really is not something that you would include in an action entertainment these days. So I will say that there are parts of it that have not aged well, but I think the rest of it is, it's just kind of caper fun. Anna Nicole Smith with, you know, running around a building the same way Bruce Willis does, or trying to, at least. So right. That's
doing his best at
that. That's
doing
that's
her best.
Doing her best. Yeah. That's my five. My four is Die Hard on a Plane, in particular this one with Wesley Snipes from 1992, and that's Passenger 57, mm-hmm. Which I think is a lot of fun. And one sign of a great film is if you walk out with quotes, with great lines, and this is the this is where Wesley says, "Always bet on black." That's that's where that line originally comes from. Passenger 57. I think is fun action.
Right. I liked it, but I gotta say, I always found it to be too short. They don't drag out the story, or they don't draw out the story. I wouldn't say drag it out, because drag it out is negative. They don't draw it out enough. And the bad guy is far too superficial.
Right. It is a little quick, which is strange, because people that know me or have heard me talk about movies, it's very rare that I will say a movie is too short. It's 85 minutes, I think. I think 100 minutes is like the perfect movie length, an hour 40.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, Casablanca, the best movie ever made, is 102. So, if you're going to go longer than that, you better be very good. So, they could have done another 10 or 15 minutes to kind of fill it out. It is a quick, it's something like 85 minutes. It is a quick watch. Passenger 57. My number three is Die Hard on a Bus. And I'm sure the listeners are guessing that already. Just from that description, it's from 1994 Speed, which is a great fun film with Keanu Reeves and Sandra Bullock and Dennis Hopper. And it's strange because from the description, I would think like there's no way this could be a good film. Like the setup seems so ridiculous and so arbitrary to say,
especially in '93.
Yeah.
When you say, okay, Keanu Reeves, come on, you're taking Ted and you're putting him on a bus, you know.
Well, speaking of, unlikely action stars at that point. Yeah, Keanu Reeves and Sandra Bullock, but also just talking about the bus can't slow down? Right. How does that work? How do you set that up? But they did it.
My favorite Speed reference is from, have you ever seen Mad About You?
No.
TV show with Paul Reiser?
Oh, Paul Reiser and Helen.
He's like a documentary director. So there's one episode where it's just a throwaway line right at the beginning of the episode where he's going through his wallet. And he pulls out a piece of paper and it says, bomb on a bus goes off after 55, if it goes below 55. And he goes, nah, never happened. And he throws the piece of paper away. That type of thing.
All right. Yeah, that's great.
Yeah.
My number two from 1979 is Die Hard in Outer Space, and that's Alien, is one of the few Die Hard films that precede Die Hard, but I think it fits into that category. Specifically the kind of the third act when it's just Ripley on her own trying to escape the alien.
Right.
So that's my number two. That's a great film. And then number one is it's just the best. It's it's Die Hard in a home with a child who's all alone. It's Home Alone, with Macaulay Culkin from 1990. I think that's my favorite, die-hard genre film.
Yeah, I always love that film is listed. I'm not the biggest fan of Home Alone like a lot of people are. I enjoy it, but I think I was also not the right age when I saw it, because I was already 16 or 17 when I first saw it.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, it was, you know, it wasn't as interesting as people who are a little younger might have seen it. But I like the fact that it's always put on these lists of a diehard type of thing. And most people don't even realize that, you know, you can put a movie like Home Alone in that situation.
Yeah.
You know, which is great. So yeah, that's a great choice. All right, great. That's really good. Thank you very much for that. So you want to tell people how they can get in touch with you be able to sleep in one of your drawers?
Yeah, well, so you can hear me talk about films and my podcast is the Next Scene Podcast, and we're at nextscenepod.com and Next Scene Pod on the social media. And we do one of the things we do is a holiday special every year around Christmas or Thanksgiving. The United States Thanksgiving, that's at the end of November, we'll do a holiday special. And actually, 1 year we covered Home Alone as our holiday special. I think we broke it up into six parts. Not quite the minute by minute treatment that you're doing here with Die Hard, but you can hear us talk about Home Alone and many other films at nextscenepod.com.
All right, great. And finding me is very simple. All you do is just a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook, find me on Twitter, or you can go directly to our website. I'm not even going to ask you if you want to come back again tomorrow, Sean. I think I have to ask myself.
Are you going to come back tomorrow?
Do I want to stay here for another day and come back tomorrow? And the answer is definitely yes, because you've so far been a very gracious host for today. So let's hope tomorrow you'll still be as gracious of a host and won't have enough of me by then. So until tomorrow, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay.